Are you tired of the 24-hour news cycle of doom? Check out this week's sponsor, the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Join them for insightful and inspiring interviews with citizen changemakers from all walks of life. The most recent episode explores building political power for and by Indigenous communities with Nick Tilson. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of government at Cornell University, Suzanne Mettler, co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy. Also on the program, and Romney does it. McConnell now has the votes. Welcome to your new Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the Pentagon diverted funds meant to stockpile personal protection equipment for nurses and doctors and diverted that money to weapons. Federal judge allows Nevada to move forward with mail-in voting. And another federal judge extends the Wisconsin absentee cutoff by 6 days. DOJ blows off congressional hearings. And new polls show that the Supreme Court of the United States now has some electoral potency for the left. Manhattan DA... the court filing says it has grounds to investigate Trump for tax fraud. New report by The Nation magazine, feds tapped Portland protesters' phones. And the Guardian paper has evidence of a huge mail slowdown after DeJoy took over. FinCEN docs show that banks are turning a blind eye to terror and syndicate funds transfers, and all this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I am I'm in the Brooklyn studio. We're going to be switching back and forth. Oddly enough, I've said this before, the Brooklyn studio is actually more of a problem in the short term. We're gonna try and fix some of this stuff because it's simply not set up for this remote stuff. So I'm getting a little bit of feedback in my ears as I talk. So it's a little bit. So if I seem a little agitated, that is part of it. And then, of course, there's a lot of other reasons to be agitated. We are now witnessing, and this is. Well, we're not quite there yet with the Joe Biden administration, but when we do get to a Joe Biden administration, knock on wood, the playing field shifts. And the roadblock to any type of, really, I want to say progressive, but I could also just simply say most popular reforms in the country will be Democrats in one half, I don't know, one third, five eighths of the party. So we have people like Dianne Feinstein, and I can understand coming out and saying, or holding, or keeping one's powder dry right now about packing the court. Or any other court reforms, because I'm open to both packing the court and also diminishing the power of the court. I would be open to both simultaneously, frankly. And one can come up with an argument that it makes sense to keep the powder dry because nothing is going to prevent Mitch McConnell from taking this vote. If he has 50 votes, and now it appears he might have 51, but if he has 50 and Mike Pence comes in, he has the votes. And if he has the votes, he will seat a Supreme Court justice because he understands, many people do, that a 6-3 court where Brett Kavanaugh becomes the swing vote can inhibit everything from single-payer health care to a Green New Deal or even like a green, not quite new deal to the capacity of executive agencies to regulate banking industry, food suppliers, distributors, drug manufacturers. I mean, the 6-3 conservative court, abortion rights, is going to have a dramatic effect on this country. And this is Mitch McConnell's legacy. He will fulfill it. I have talked to people who know the workings of the Senate, people who have worked for a Democratic Senate majority leader. There is nothing that can be done. You can gum up the works, but not enough. There's just simply no way to stop him if he has the votes. There's just no way of doing it. You can hold up the continuing resolution. The government can shut down, and apparently the Senate can still hold confirmation hearings. Democrats can not show up, and they may not. But they may decide to show up to show the American public what they're getting in terms of Supreme Court justice, or they may say that they're not, it doesn't matter. There's no continuing resolution. There's no withholding unanimous consent that will run out the clock. There's simply no way to stop it if he's got the votes. And people were holding out hope. Murkowski, Collins have said that they wouldn't take this vote before the election. Susan Collins is in great jeopardy. Her brand is such that if she said she had to vote, if she voted for this, she'd be in bigger trouble than she is now. Mitch McConnell released her because he knew he had the other votes. But what about Cory Gardner on the ropes in Colorado? Well, Cory Gardner probably wants to work in Republican politics or be a lobbyist or something like that, so he's going to go along with it. But what about Mitt Romney? In fact, it was just a couple of days ago that one of Mitt Romney's closest political advisors chastised me for simply saying that Mitt Romney was a nice guy, because apparently I didn't realize how honorable he was. Here is a reminder of that clip. This is Stuart Stevens.
My whole thing is I try not to be friends or know anybody I can possibly know in politics, so I don't really assess them.
Can I just say something? It's sure. A little bit condescending to say he's a nice guy.
Well, okay.
Because because if ever we've had a lesson that character matters and the quality of the person matters, it's right now. So Mitt Romney stood up to Trump, that he called out Trump in April. It's more than just being nice. He's actually been courageous about this, that he would vote, be the only person in his party that would vote for impeachment. So I think that
what's the polling? Okay. Trump's approval rating in Utah. I mean, he's going to win because people don't want to vote for a Democrat, but his approval rating is around 52%. So pretty bold stuff. But here's the problem with the concept of a never Trumper, of a man whose character is judged simply because he voted for impeachment of a president who clearly deserved to be impeached. The issue with this justice sitting down is that Mitch McConnell denied Barack Obama a choice. It wasn't even, it really didn't even matter who it was. I mean, Merrick Garland was about as, you know, moderate a choice as you could get, as the least offensive choice as you could get to Mitch McConnell. Didn't matter who it was. They denied him a choice, even though there was a vacancy starting in February of 2016. Mitch McConnell allowed there to be eight justices for almost a year. In fact, I think it was a year. He changed the number of sitting justices to eight based upon a principle that he completely threw out the window when, of course, it was politically expedient. Now, I'm not surprised by that. But it is despicable. I mean, if you are really resting your hat on this type of honor, then you would imagine that someone with such honor and such integrity would step to the fore and say, hey, in 2016, this Senate said we would not have hearings for a Supreme Court justice with an imminent election. And by gosh, because I have so much integrity and honorability, I will uphold that principle. What's good for the goose or the gander is good for the other goose or gander or whatever it is. And so here I give you Mitt Romney with such a bold statement.
The side of the Constitution and precedent as I've studied it and make the decision on that basis.
Senator, you said that in your release that you would look at a nominee's qualifications. What qualifications are you looking for, and what would make you not consider someone that President Trump is putting forward?
Well, I think it's straightforward in terms of the qualifications you look for, which is someone who is an expert of the law, someone who has a record of fairness and judgment that you think is consistent with the law. I prefer choosing those folks who are, if you will, strict constructionists, meaning that they look at the law itself and the Constitution, as opposed to sort of looking into the sky and pulling out ideas that they think may be more appropriate than either the law or the Constitution. So I recognize that we may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it's had over the last few decades. But my liberal friends have, over many decades, gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court. And that's not written in the stars. And I know that a lot of people are saying, gosh, we don't want that change. I understand the energy associated with that perspective. But it's also appropriate for a nation which is, if you will, center-right, to have a court which reflects center-right points of view, which, again, are not changing the law from what it states, but instead following the law and following the Constitution.
Okay, so there it is, Mitt Romney saying that somehow he's completely ignoring the fact that there was a seat stolen from Barack Obama, and completely ignoring as if that happened because he's so honorable. Also, he's so honorable that he recognizes this is a center right country, despite the fact that there has not been a Republican president who won his first term in office with a majority of votes of this country since Ronald Reagan. George Bush did not win the majority of votes in 2000. He won in 2004 as an incumbent. His father did not get a majority of votes. You got to go back to Ronald Reagan. You've got a Senate that is dominated by 45% of the country. And so I give you is the man of great honor. But Republicans are going to do as Republicans do. Well, it doesn't matter if they're against Trump, because they still have an agenda to that is contrary to the vast majority of people in this country. And 100% of them do. That's the difference. There's no doubt in my mind that there's half, a third of the Democratic caucus in the Senate are people that we could not rely on ideologically in most circumstances or many circumstances. But with the Republicans, you get 100% guarantee. Murkowski, incidentally, won, I think, a write-in candidacy. Susan Collins is just a liar. She's if they needed her vote, she'd be there, believe me. A couple ads we got. Both of these are products I use. 70% of people who say they want natural products, only 2% actually buy them. Why? Because what they sell at the store is from the biggest companies and not necessarily the ones that are best for you. Where do you start? Grove Collaborative. Grove is the online marketplace that delivers healthy home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. Grove Collaborative takes the guesswork out of going green. Every grove.co, not com, it's grove.co product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. They got a bunch of different brands there. Mrs. Myers, 7th Generation, Burt's Bees. Basically, during the pandemic, I went all in. Everyone knows that I like the 7th Generation stuff because it has no scent. I use the one that has no scent. I got the hand, the containers here in the office. I use the dish soap at home. But then during the early days of the lockdown, I went all in on buying a bunch of, I guess, the Grove brand, or made their big containers. And I bought some of they have glass bottles and some with the rubber round for the kids, hand soap things. That's the way I do it now. I just refill it over and over again. And I've done it everywhere. And they got foaming soap for the kids that smells of pineapple, which I can handle. I just can't handle floral stuff. Grove has been fantastic. I get my sponges there. I get my natural cleaners, and you have it in concentrate. Can't go wrong. With Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores. You don't have to search endlessly online. All the natural products you want in one place. You can join over 2 million households who have trusted Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, shipping fast, free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners of this program go to grove.co/majority, you're going to get a free cleaning gift set. Plus free shipping with your first order. Go to grove.co/majority. Get this exclusive offer, grove.co/majority. As you know, I've been going through some internet problems in our remote location. I am just on the verge of getting fiber. I was having a little problem with my router. I was on the phone with the tech guy. It's a little bit country up there. So the tech guy is just actually have a cell phone number. And, he's telling me as I'm talking to him that he can see that my router's connected, even though we have some miscommunication. I'm not going to go into the details of that. And I started talking to him and he's like, he can see all of my activity. And I got a little freaked by that. But the fact of the matter is your ISP can see every site that you've ever visited. Even if you use incognito mode on your browser, even if you clear your history, doesn't matter who your provider is, Comcast, Verizon, doesn't matter. In the U.S., they can also legally sell your data to ad companies. So I freaked a little bit, but I do use ExpressVPN. It's an app that reroutes your encrypts your internet connection through their secure servers, so your internet provider cannot see the sites you visit. It protects 100% of your data with best-in-class encryption. ExpressVPN is easy to use. You just tap one button, and boom, you're protected. It's available on all your devices. You can have it on your phone, your computer, and router. It runs seamlessly in the background. There's no lagging, no buffering. ExpressVPN is rated number one VPN by CNET and Wired. And your whole family will be protected under one subscription. Easy to use it on your phone. Easy to use it on your computer. And I guess presumably on your iPad or whatever it is. And also, you know, that benefit about getting, you can change your address. You can be in Europe. You can get all the European streaming stuff. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. Get an extra 3 months free on your 1 year package. That's express, expressvpn.com/majority. expressvpn.com/majority. Check it out. And lastly, one of our sponsors today, of course, Sunset Lake CBD. SunsetLakeCBD.com. They are farmers up in Vermont outside of Burlington. They used to exclusively provide dairy, or for Ben and Jerry's, they would provide some. They went, they started to grow hemp. They did it along with the help of the University of Vermont to implement regenerative agricultural practices. Their hemp is 100% pesticide free. They only use organic fertilizers. They have great business practices, minimum wage $15 an hour. Employees own a majority of the company, and their CBD is fantastic. When I sleep, one of the few reasons I do is because of my CBD tinctures. Sometimes I hit the 750 mil. Sometimes I hit the 1500 mil. If I'm really feeling a little tense, 3000 mil. They have smokables. They have gummy bears. They have infused coffee. They have a great salve that works both for your joints, your aches, and in my narrow case, my eczema. Matt can attest. Matt, what's your favorite? The smalls, right?
Yeah, the smalls are my favorite because they go right into the grinder easy. But I also like the hemp salve with arnica. It's got like shea butter, beeswax stuff in it. I'm a fan of that as well.
Wow, I had no idea. Folks, check this out, and you get 20% off with the coupon code LEFTISBEST. LEFTISBEST, 20% off, sunsetlakecbd.com. They're fans of the show. They came to me and said, we want to do LEFTISBEST. One word, 20% off. Check it out. You will not be disappointed. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And, oh, do we have... we do, in fact. Okay, well, I'd like to welcome back to the program... a professor of government from Cornell University, co-author of Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy, Susan Mettler. Suzanne Mettler, welcome to the program. You're a co-author, of course, Robert Lieberman. But welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
So, okay. So I guess the obvious question to begin with, and you go through some great historical examples, and some of which I'd like to talk about in terms of different times where we've had these threats. But you outline, obviously, four distinct threats to our democracy. And fundamentally, your argument is that we uniquely have all four going at the current time. But walk us through the four threats.
That's right. Well, there are four threats that scholars who study the rise and decline of democracies around the world know about, that these are things that make democracy more fragile. And so they are political polarization, which, you know, we certainly have today. It's been rising, particularly since the 1980s in the United States. Conflict over who belongs as a member of the political community. This is typically a conflict over race or gender. In the United States, we find that conflict over the status of African Americans has been a perennial and recurring threat. The third is high and rising economic inequality, which has been on the rise in the United States since the 1970s. And the fourth is executive aggrandizement. And what this refers to is the concentration of power in the top leader. So in the United States, after, you know, traditionally having a system that was more Congress-centered, the president has gained more power right from the 1930s onward. And both parties have contributed to that. But today, for the first time ever, we have all four of these threats in combination. We've, there's been They've each had their own history in the United States of waxing and waning over time and combining in different ways. When even one of them was present, it could create a lot of havoc for the political system. When three were present, which occurred in the 1850s, it led to the Civil War. In the 1890s, it led to the disenfranchisement of millions of African-American men. And then that lasted for, 60 years. Today, for the first time ever, we have all four threats raging at once. So we're in a really precarious situation. American democracy has been fragile at many times in the past. I think we've had the luxury of forgetting about that. But now it's fragile again.
All right. So I want to circle back to these four and also sort of how they manifest itself and also, when we've seen the various combinations throughout history. But let's turn for a moment to, I guess, just the other part of your title. Makes it easy. I just work at that level. What do we mean when we say American democracy, right? I mean, what are we really talking about? I know you write it's on a continuum, and it feels like at it's on a continuum, but it's also on sometimes maybe a bit of like a hamster wheel. And sometimes it goes, it waxes and wanes as well. Or maybe that is when we are, So tell us what we mean when we say democracy, particularly in the context of America.
Yeah, I like that question. It's nicely put. So, some people might assume that the United States has been democratic from the beginning. And, with my students, we study the Constitution, and there are certainly ways in which the United States scaled up the whole notion of democracy for the world and introduced the ideas of representative government on a large scale and freedom of religion, and so on. But of course, there were ways in which the founding was really undemocratic, anti-democratic, with slavery being incorporated into the Constitution, being the most obvious of those. And so in the United States, it's fair to say that democracy has developed over time. And I would say that it was really the 1960s that we became a fully democratic nation where civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights were extended to all Americans, regardless of race and gender and so on. And so that was a long story about this arc of democratization. But what we're looking at in the book is periods of time where people were worried that whatever level of democracy had developed up till that point in time was under threat of deteriorating, of backsliding, that we could go back in the other direction of having less democracy. And it's really striking to me the number of times this has happened in the United States and when people had real anxiety that there was going to be backsliding. So that's our concern we were motivated to write the book by asking, is the United States in danger today of democratic deterioration? And the idea is not that there'll be tanks in the streets and, a military coup d'etat. Scholars who study democratic deterioration find that while that kind of thing was common up through the middle of the 20th century, what's been more typical since then is backsliding, where you get some features of democracy that stay in place, like you might still have elections, and yet other aspects like the rule of law and the integrity of rights might be undermined, might become weaker.
This may be a little bit off topic, but tangentially speaking, I mean, where does economic rights fall in that spectrum? Because you mentioned that, in the 60s, we had sort of reached a peak, theoretically, in terms of democracy within this continuum. Could we argue that does that include some form of economic rights? I mean, have we lost, have we become less democratic in the context of economics are we backsliding? Like, for instance, when you disempower unions, definitionally, it seems to me that you have less union concentration. That is definitionally, it seems to me, less democratic. correct? And because the economy, obviously, and economic rights must be a factor within sort of assessing where we are on the continuum of democracy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agree that in a full and robust definition of democracy, it would include social rights and economic rights. In this book, we take more of a narrow, more strict definition of rights as being civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights. But the kinds of dynamics you're mentioning are really important as a threat to democracy because, you know, this feature of rising economic inequality. Now, you know, when I first heard that that can be a threat to democracy, I thought that must mean, well, the 99% rises up and you have instability. But that's not, in fact, what it means. It's actually the opposite. Scholars find that around the world and through history, when there's high and rising economic inequality, it's the most affluent, the rich and powerful industries and businesses that then they decide to try to cement their power, to lock down what they have. And they don't care if they trample democracy in the process. And so I think, you know, we've been seeing that going on already over the last couple of decades as economic elites with their political accomplices have scaled back the power of organized labor, as you've mentioned, of workers generally. And, you know, we're in a really bad time these days for working Americans because of their rights being scaled back. And I think that's why that's come about.
Okay. And again, forgive me for sort of, you know, harping on this, because the narrow definition is in some ways relative to the, I guess, to America in and of itself. And aspirationally, right? But I mean, it seems like there is an argument to be made that a broader definition of democracy would necessarily include not just the ability to vote or the civil rights, you know, the ability to marry who you want, and but also it would involve certain economic rights that would constitute other freedoms, right? That are also inherent to democracy, like the same ills that can destabilize a society or at least chip away at those other those other democratic rights seems to me to be almost inherent as a democratic right in and of itself. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And, you know, a lot of my earlier work, and you and I've been happy to speak with you about some of my earlier books. Right. I'm really focused on those kinds of things about, you know, how can the United States become more democratic and so that people have rights to, you know, healthcare and fair working conditions and all of those things. But in the book, when I say we take a more narrow definition, it's because we're looking at things that we thought were settled.
Okay.
Where there's not policy debates that have still been going on around them over the past many decades. And, you know, I would put the economic rights there's been more debate over those. But I thought voting rights were a settled matter. And now we're seeing, you know, a lot of efforts in this election to really scale back on free and fair elections and the integrity of the election.
I mean, in some respects, you know, that the scaling back on voting rights certainly predated Trump, right? I mean, we had the Supreme Court roll back the Voting Rights Act,
right,
despite the fact that a duly elected Senate and a duly, you know, had reauthorized that very bill. I mean, that to me. All right. Well, so let's go and look at these four threats, and then we'll talk about two at different times where they have sort of combined. Because you write about the expanse of presidential power. It starts really in many respects with FDR, and increases. The political polarization seems to wax and wane over different periods. You know, I've interviewed people who said, in the 50s, people were complaining that there was no difference, no discernible difference between the parties at all. on any type of issues. Rising inequality waxes and wanes. And the question of who belongs, that seems to have, seems to be a dynamic that exists in terms of like who's asserting their right to belong at different times, right? I mean, and can we start with that one? Because I mean, what's happening now is that there is a pushback against sort of, I think, you know, something like Black Lives Matter, at least by, you know, a portion of society. I would suggest broadly the white part of society, but also we're, you know, that is because there's a greater assertion of like of black rights in the country. But of course, we're also seeing simultaneously a diminishment of immigrant rights.
Right. Yes, exactly. So this, you know, conflict over who belongs, this, the scholars who study this in countries worldwide, they say that it can be most problematic and recurring if there is a group that, when the country is founded, is really excluded. And so, of course, in the United States, you know, the classic case of that is African Americans' status. And so, you know, until that's really dealt with, a formative rift, as it's called, can create havoc again and again and again. But the interesting thing, and I think what you're noting, is that that's not always the case. So there are some periods of democratic instability in the country where, in fact, conflict over race was not part of it, and not because problems had been solved, rather because they were being suppressed. So this is the case in the 1790s and again in the 1930s, where both sides in the conflict, both parties, as many things as they might have disagreed about, they did not disagree about race. That was kind of taken off the table. Like, we're not going to upset the racial hierarchy. But then there are other periods when you have political polarization, and one of the things the parties is polarized about is racial inequality and the status of African Americans. And so that's very much the case now. You know, it's kind of striking because it would have seemed to a lot of political scientists, like in the late 20th century and early 21st century, like racism was really declining in the United States. And then the country elected our first black president. And then, you know, after that, here's this resurgence of racism. But in fact, what it is it's not that it's widespread across society. It's very concentrated in one party, in the Republican Party. So what's happened is that the country's become much more diverse over the last several decades, but the Republican Party's been kind of standing still, and its composition does not reflect that greater diversity, whereas the Democratic Party does. So you've got a very white party. And then when you look at people's attitudes, Republicans versus Democrats, there's measures that political scientists use called racial resentment. It's a measure of racism. It's actually like people's agreement about questions that tap into, you know, why does racial inequality persist? And resentment is associated with answers that say, well, it's really the fault of African Americans because they lack a work ethic, they're lazy, et cetera. Whereas an answer that is really promoting of racial inequality would say, well, there are persistent laws or historic legacies of laws that have caused this racial inequality. And so Democrats and Republicans have diverged over the last few decades in how they answer those questions. So Democrats have become much more embracing of greater equality. Republicans have become more racially resentful. And so that sets up a big conflict. And so, you know, part of what's driving polarization is that conflict. And so this, it's really organized along partisan lines these days.
So let's go back so you mentioned the 1790s, where we had that that polarization, but we did not have the contention over, you know, who was the in-group. I mean, not a way in at least amongst, I guess, folks like us, we would see in a positive way, but it was not in contention at that point. And you had things, I guess, like the Whiskey Rebellion at that time. And let's move forward. You mentioned the next sort of like big. You know what? Before we get there, well, I guess the 1850s is really the time where you have three of these elements converge. And of course, it leads us. And that is quite obviously the who's the in group, right? Should we have slaves or not becomes an issue. The other is political polarization. And then the third is rising inequality. Okay, let's talk about those. I mean, of course, at this point, we did not have expansive presidential power, or maybe we wouldn't have had a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, you tell me.
Well, I think, you know, if those three threats were not present in the way they were, we might not have had a civil war. I mean, what happened was that, you know, the South, coming out of the Constitutional Convention, the South was privileged in politics because of the Three-Fifths Compromise, which effectively gave slaveholders and their states extra power in terms of representation in the country. So they were able to, you know, say that they were on board with the project of democracy, going along with representation and elections. But this was democracy on white man's terms, and really on Southerners' terms. But as time went on, they began to lose some of that political power because the country is becoming more and more competitive, and there was abolitionists were succeeding in getting, you know, more and more supporters who were anti-slavery. And so then the South begins to lose power, and they realize if we keep playing this game of democracy, we're going to lose slavery. And they made a choice at that point, which was it going to be slavery or going by these rules of the game? And they chose slavery. So at that point, you know,
what would have gone by the rules of the game meant in terms of like being subjected to what the North wanted to do,
starting to lose in elections. And in the book, we tell the whole story of what was happening in Kansas. You know, it was a territory. And so it had to decide whether it was going to be slave or free. And you had the two different sides in Kansas. They just couldn't even agree on how to run elections in order to make these decisions for the territory. And so they would have their own elections and not respect each other's, et cetera. And then that became a microcosm of what began to happen in national politics as well. So, and you know, then ultimately Lincoln is elected and the South secedes because it just, you know, can't go along with that at all. And so it says, we're out of here. And that's what happens with polarization. It's why polarization ultimately is a threat to democracy if one side decides we want to win on our priorities at all costs, and we don't care if we run roughshod over democracy in the process.
I mean, as you talk about that advantage that the South had in terms of the Three-Fifths Compromise, right, where they were able to get basically extra voting power relative to who they had to distribute resources to, which is essentially, I guess, what that comes down to, sort of feels a little bit reminiscent of what our Senate composition is right now, and that we've had two Republican presidents who have won their first elections in a row with less votes than the person who lost the election. And you start to wonder, and of course, we see this dynamic, let's say, in Wisconsin, and we see it in Pennsylvania on some level, although Pennsylvania, I guess, has sort of fixed itself in some respects. But this idea of the minority of people, of voters, have elected what the majority of lawmakers. And at one point, those of us who are voting for people and saying, hey, wait a second, this is supposed to work like where if you get more votes, and, you know, It's one thing to have it happen in the presidential election. We have a quirky system. I mean, it's another to have it exclusively in the Senate, where it's like, okay, 40% of the country is determining what the other 60%, you know, what the values and the structure is for 60%. And you start to see this in states. Like at one point, the people who are saying that, wait, I'm getting 3/5 of a vote here, essentially, or 4/5 of a vote. We're going to change the system if we get in position of power. The other side is going to feel that loss pretty, we could be talking about court packing. We could be talking about, Washington, D.C. is going to be made into a state, I think. Puerto Rico is a sort of a separate set of issues. But there may be, you know, genuine reforms that begins to put this back in balance. And that is the problem, that the side that had been enjoying this advantage, they then are faced with that loss. I mean, that seems to be like the story of everything that's going on now, is that people who have had an advantage perceive their loss of an advantage as oppressive in some way.
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot to that. And there are a lot of political scientists who study political behavior, and they're finding this, that resentment is a real underlying theme in politics that we're seeing these days, and that has been driving the Republican Party in many ways. But, you know, today's Republican Party is becoming a party that does not want to play by the rules, and that does not want to, you know, abide by these, what I call the pillars of democracy: free and fair elections, rule of law, legitimacy of the opposition, and integrity of rights. But rather wants to win at all costs, be able to, you know, stack the courts at all costs, be able to pursue its policy priorities at all costs, even if these pillars of democracy are violated in the process. And, you know, we see this, as you noted earlier, these trends well predate Trump. They've been emerging for some time, for many years. And we see Trump as, you know, more of an outcome of that process. And we think it will continue long after he's gone from public office, whenever that is. So I think, you know, our political system, because of the kinds of things you're mentioning, we're in for a long period of careening. And so it's really important for people to get straight in their heads what it is that's our priority. And I think that we need to be thinking about these basic principles of democracy and embracing them. I think for a long time we were able to take them for granted, and we can't now. And, you know, it's easy for people to get very focused on their policy priorities, but I think unless we really come together to protect democracy, that it's a losing battle, because ultimately, who's in charge if you don't have democracy? It's really just the most affluent people, the most organized interests, the most powerful industries, and everyone else is really out of the picture.
I want to come back to that, because those are basically the settled issues that you were talking about, those principles that create the structure where theoretically you have a better opportunity to have policies that are reflected in the desires of people, right? I mean, that's the idea, is that you create the bucket, and then, you know, we all have different ideas of what the water is, but the people will decide what it is as long as the bucket is holding water. But I want to go back in history just a little bit, because I did not know anything about that Wilmington, North Carolina situation in the late 1890s. Right. And it's fascinating. I mean, this era, I say this almost every day now, but this era, this Reconstruction and sort of post-Reconstruction era is just like a massive blind spot in our national consciousness. And the more you see, hear about it, the more you sort of understand it as to why it is a blind spot. It's almost like this sort of like these traumas that the country has been forgetting, but have been gnawing away at us. Tell us about that, what happened in Wilmington, because this is, it really is stunning.
It is stunning. And, you know, everything you just said is so well put. While I was working on this chapter for many months, it was eye-opening to me and deeply, deeply disturbing. So in the late 19th century, you know, I think a lot of Americans know that we had Reconstruction and then it formally speaking comes to an end. But what people don't know is that in the decades after that, in the late 19th century, that African Americans in the South continued to vote in many states at pretty high levels and to run for office at all levels. There were, you know, members of Congress, but there were a lot of people in local office in particular. And so democracy there and elsewhere in the country seemed to be pretty healthy. You had very competitive and robust political parties, and you had people participating in politics at high rates, men who had elected, who had voting rights at that point in time, of course. Then you get to the 1890s, and Southern Democrats, which was the party run by white elites, business people in the South, they were really getting tired of having to compete in every election. And it was becoming harder for them because African Americans, who tended to be Republicans, found that if they could ally forces with the new populists who were emerging, who were tended to be lower middle income white people, that they could actually win elections. They would work together and create what they called a fusion ballot and, you know, run candidates from both of their parties together, and they could beat the Democrats. And this happened in North Carolina during the 1890s. So at some point, the Democrats there said, okay, we've had enough. We're going to pull out the stops. We've been trying everything. We've been stuffing ballot boxes. We've been using the threat of violence. It's not enough. And what they did is they staged a coup d'etat in the city of Wilmington on November 10th, 1898. This was a city where African Americans had been really moving into the middle class and were being elected, were serving on the city council and in all sorts of positions. And that all came crashing down in one day.
And excuse me, if I remember correctly, too, you wrote there was one position that was appointed where you had and it was appointed, a black man was appointed, and he would be the highest paid individual in the city government of anybody. And that created a tremendous amount of resentment.
You know, we're going back to the resentment theme again here. I think there was a lot of resentment. When I look at all these documents from that period, you can really see it writ large. And so, but on the morning of November 10th, there were thousands of people, white men in paramilitary groups that had, some of them were really organized by the Democratic Party. And they gathered at the city armory, and then they marched to the offices of this black-owned newspaper, and they burned it down. And then from there, they marched into black neighborhoods. And as the day wore on, they killed hundreds of people. And they took others. They took various city leaders and, you know, high-ranking people to the train station and made them leave town. And at the end of the day, they actually at gunpoint made those who were the city officials resign their positions, and then they installed their own handpicked folks in their place. Within a few weeks after that, they managed to now change in the state the requirements for voting and to introduce literacy tests and poll taxes. And this same thing, like we really, in the book, we highlight North Carolina because there with this coup d'etat, things came out into the open that were happening more quietly in states all over the South. All over the South, they managed to have constitutional conventions and to change the constitutions to have these poll taxes and literacy tests, disenfranchising African Americans. And once people lost their voting rights, once they lost political power, then in turn, they lost civil liberties and civil rights. You had Jim Crow was set up. And, you know, what we tend to, I think of this as, well, that just happened in one region, that happened in the South. But it was sanctioned by national leaders in the Republican Party, by President McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt and Taft, who all, you know, looked the other way and condoned it while all of this was happening. And it also meant that white supremacists in the South then had extra leverage, again, the way they had under the Three-Fifths Clause, had extra leverage again in national politics and shaped our national politics for the next 60 years. So it's a really consequential story.
And in terms of the implications for now, what struck me was you had this very, very concentrated brief window of violence, and then everything in it almost like, you know, even in the context of doing the show, like when there's growth with this show, it's a spike, it drops back down, but it achieves a new normal. Mm-hmm. If you look at that sort of concentrated moment of violence, and it literally we're talking like a week, and enough happened in that moment where they were able to sort of change, then immediately institutionalize this new normal into changes in voting laws and the way that that then had a durability that lasted decades. I mean, it sort of feels like we're going along here, and it's quite possible that the next 3 months of this country's future will determine decades of where we go after that. And that, to me, that's what that Wilmington thing, I mean, in addition to, like, this is a moment in history I had no idea about. And there's multiple stories over the years that I have, like, heard of this, particularly around race, where, you know, obviously in Tulsa, but also the Northwest Territories, where you had just assaults on Black people who had basically, you know, succeeded in the way that we talk about this, or we're in the process of success in attaining, and boom, within a very short window of time, there's like a violent turn, a spike of extra lawful activity, if you will. And then it just gets institutionalized because those things are fixed. And, you know, we're looking at like a 6-3 Supreme Court. That's one of those things. Or we're looking at a, you know, I mean, these are, that's what I find really disturbing about it. I mean, I think that's why you wrote the book.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I so appreciate you laying all of that out, because that's exactly what my co-author and I were seeing as we laid out this story. And it's why watching this year of 2020 evolve, you know, since the book went off to press, and, you know, we were already seeing some eroding around the pillars of democracy, but in the months since it went off to press, things have become much worse. And we think we're at a really dangerous and troubling time.
And we should say we're talking on a day where there's a report, at least by The Nation magazine, that you had DHS people, you know, cloning people's phones in Portland to, you know, and there's some speculation that the arrests of these unmarked federal policemen were arresting people off the streets because they thought they knew what they were going to do in the future because of having their phone information. I mean, so, okay. So with all that said, what do we do about that? If we went back to Wilmington, you know, in I guess October, and we had the ability to warn everybody there, what would we have said?
Golly, you know, it's a big question. I mean, I think it's the right way to phrase the question, because often people say to me, well, how can we rein in these four threats? And, you know, reining in the four threats, that's really hard. And that may take years or decades to rein in political polarization, for example. And really the question is more urgent. It's the way you just phrased it. It's, you know, what would you have told the folks in Wilmington a month ahead of time? I mean, the folks in Wilmington probably should have, you know, if we could have warned them with the hindsight of history, we would have told them to get out of town for the time being. But I think that Americans really need to know what is at stake right now. I think there's such, you know, the past few years, the news every day is overwhelming. And it's hard to sort it all out. And it's hard to sort out which stories are just kind of, you know, about unsavory tweets that are kind of offensive versus which stories are about policy changes that actually matter versus, and then policy changes versus these fundamental changes to the pillars of democracy that can erode the system and stack the deck for some time to come. And so we're trying to shine a bright light on the latter and how important it is to preserve those things. I mean, fortunately, at this moment, Americans can still choose. There's nothing deterministic about these threats that that you know shape the outcome of history. And right now we have an election coming up that if people actually take part in it at large numbers, they can have their voices heard. I mean, I do think there's a lot of there are a lot of efforts to be tipping the scales in the election, but I think that overwhelming participation can make those things less important.
Yeah, I mean, it occurs to me that, you know, if we were to take that time travel thing and land in October in Wilmington, 1898, you know, it would be just expand your imagination a little bit of how bad this can get, you know, in the short term. And obviously, you at that point, you're only 30 years out from slavery. So, you know, the idea of like a massacre wouldn't be that, you wouldn't have to expand your imagination too much. I mean, I think it's quite easy 30 years out if there is a vibrant middle class and you have, you know, black politicians and you have black leaders of the community and a majority of black people living in that area, it might be harder than I think we can imagine now, right? 30 years goes like this when you look back on history, but in the context of actually living it, feels like a lifetime ago, maybe for some of these people on some level. We don't have that. I think violence is really not so much the issue, but I look at things like, you know, Azar taking over the FDA, and we know why they're doing that. It is because they want the ability to sort of say, like, the vaccine is here, or something to that effect. And we see this in agency after agency. We see the DOJ today say, we're not coming to your congressional hearings because last time you were there, you were very petulant and you didn't ask me the right questions. So you don't get a second bite at this apple. You know, you suspend the sort of like concern about that because you think, well, the election will happen. But, you know, regardless of how many people come out to vote, there's still an opportunity that, that Donald Trump may end up being president. And then all of these things that we're talking about as anomalies become institutionalized for the next at least 4 years. And gosh knows what the opportunity is going to be 4 years from now. We have already seen the fecklessness of Congress at this point to deal with this. There's no reason to think that they're going to be particularly more adept at this if they have another bite at the apple. It's incredibly concerning. And I guess I appreciate your coming to talk to us about it. I don't think I'm going to sleep very much again tonight. The book is The Four Threats, The Recurring Crisis of American Democracy. Susan Mettler, we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I've really appreciated the conversation.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We will take a break in a moment. I think Nomi is going to join us, and she's going to reiterate to me how I pronounce her name. Apparently, I did it wrong again yesterday. And so I'm going to be taken to the woodshed again. But just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You also get extra content as a member. And don't forget, you can also listen to the AM Quickie. We do that every morning. Sometimes we have a little bit of a problem with the audio like we did today. And so I got to record it quickly again. As I tell Saul, he gets to watch an extra 10-minute video in the morning, Phineas and Ferb or whatever it is. But check that out. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Nomi!
Hi!
How are you?
I'm good. So I'm well rested.
I had like 25 people send me emails and to how to phonetically say your name, which I have been saying for years. First, I found out I was saying it wrong. And then I've been trying to say it correctly for years. And I got people going like N-O-M-E-K-E-Y.
Right.
Which doesn't necessarily help me because I don't know where the emphasis is going. And then I had somebody write me N-O-M-C-K-E-E as in Noma Key.
No, that's not it. That's how you've been saying it.
And that's how
I think. I don't know. Every time you switch it up, we should do a mashup of this because this is my life. It's not just you, Sam. So don't feel guilty.
Okay.
I really appreciate the audience. Like if my whole 36 years of people mispronouncing my name has led to a mass education where the audience is involved and I'm loving it. And I'm sure my mother's loving it too. But it is, okay, I'll show you what I used to do when I was in bars and, like, guys were hitting on me and they were like, what's your name? And I was like, Noma. And they're like, what? I would go, No-me-ki. And the accent's on the last syllable.
Okay, the accent's on the, so No-me-ki.
Yes, perfect.
No-me-ki.
Well, it's like an extra syllable for Americans is like learning another language.
It's there's something about coming from Massachusetts too to put we just like the end of a word, forget it.
That's true. Ha.
No Mickey.
Pack.
No Mickey.
No Mickey.
No Mickey.
You got it.
See, I got people now eyeing me like, no Mickey. No, it's not that.
No. It's no Mickey. No Mickey.
Okay. So, what is happening on the No Mickey show?
So now that I've educated everybody on how to say my name, I'm going to butcher my guest's name. Today we have a really good show. We have Pavlina Cherneva. She is a professor of economics at Bard College. She wrote a book recently about, it's called The Case for a Job Guarantee. I don't know if you've interviewed her or not yet, but really interesting book. And there's a write-up about it this week. So we're excited to have her on.
I'd like to interview her.
She specializes in MMT, so she's looking at it from that perspective.
There's the Levy Institute up there, I think it is, at Bard, and a lot of those MMT folks, I think, are there, I think, as well.
We have Akella Lacey and Napoleon DeLegend.
And this is at 3 p.m.
3 p.m. Eastern, right after the show. I go and I change something up and then come back into the seat.
Will you change your outfit?
No, I just, like... Change the camera or something. Yes, I'm in strategy mode now, and then I go into full like communist mode. No,
there you go. folks, check out the Antifada as well. You can find that at patreon.com/theantifada. Matt, what's happening on TMBS tonight?
Yeah, tonight we have Marshall Steinbaum, assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah. He's going to talk to us about California's AB5 law. And why we should distrust Democrats and sort of corporate Democrats who propose sectoral bargaining as a compromise position with regards to how we should categorize labor and collective bargaining. So it's kind of a wonky subject, but it should be good, folks. So that's tonight, patreon.com/TMBS and twitch.tv/literary hangover. I'll probably be doing some flight simulator later in the week.
Okay, so there you go. I'm trying to look up Sam Alito here to find out. He is 70 years old. I didn't realize he was that old. So someone just corrected me on the IM. 70 years old, Sam Alito. I guess I think of him as a 50-year-old because he was 50 when he was appointed, I think, to the court. And, well, maybe even younger than that. Wow. Yeesh. No. Yeah, 15 years ago. Oh, gosh. That's why I think of him as young. Because I remember when he was picked and he was in his 50s. That makes me feel old. Also, someone else corrected me. I think I already fulfilled this correction. But if we had a proportionate amount of deaths in this country, as opposed to having 200,000 deaths, we would have closer to 88,000 deaths relative to Canada, let's say. So we would have more than half
or less than half of the deaths that we've experienced at this point. Got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be in what we call the fun half. See you then. It might take all the strength I got. Was that it?
I had the wrong one opened up. Here it is.
Oh, here we go. We'll try that again. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.